and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Paul Rademacher of the Monroe Institute, and we're going to talk about the work at Monroe Institute and his book, The Spiritual Hitchhiker. How are you, Paul?
I'm doing great, Eva. It's wonderful to be with you tonight.
Thanks for coming on. Took me a while to get you here. I'm sorry. Should have happened sooner.
Anytime. Isn't it no time like the present? I'm just glad to be here.
So before we get started, take a few minutes and tell us a little bit about where you came from, why you do what you're doing, how you came to write your book.
Sure.
A little bit about you.
Right. I think that I didn't realize it when I was younger, but I didn't have any idea that eventually my life would be about this spiritual journey. And for me, it kind of began when I was back in 1981. I had a construction company with my brother, and the two of us were building a home, and I was working up on the roof one day, and I pulled on a board and fell off the roof because the board gave way, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I had fractured my hip. And they took me to the hospital, and they did some x-rays on the hip and didn't find anything wrong with it at first, so they put me into physical therapy, and they're moving that hip all around and, you know, cranking it this way and that way to get it loosened up. But I was just in agony because the hip was, in fact, broken. After they did some more x-rays, they found the fracture in the hip and they put me into traction. And when the doctor came by and told me I was going to be off work for quite a few weeks, I found myself going into this spiral downward of pain and anxiety. Pain because the hip was so excruciating, and anxiety because this was our busiest time of year. There was no way I could possibly be off work. And so as I'm going down, I felt this spiral downward, and all of a sudden I broke through into another reality. It was something that I had never experienced before. Didn't even know that such a thing was possible. And in that other world, the pain in the hip completely disappeared, and I was surrounded by total and complete peace, and I knew that there were no such things as accidents, and everything had meaning and purpose. And at one point, I found myself standing in front of a being of light, and we were talking about my life, but we weren't using words. And when I came out of that experience, it was so unbelievable to me, because I didn't even know things like that were possible, and if they were possible, they certainly weren't available to an ordinary person like me. I was just a building contractor. But that was something that really set the stage for me to first go into the ministry, because I had a calling of to go into church work, and I thought maybe that I could experience that world again through the church. But what I found out over time was that it even more deep than that, it was something that created a hunger for me to want to get back to that world again and to experience it and to integrate it into my life more and more. And eventually that path then led me to the Monroe Institute.
So what was your... Did you go into the ministry?
I did. I was a Presbyterian pastor for 15 years. And one of the things that happened to me while I was in the ministry was that I began to feel this great tension between what I was doing in my public life and what I really wanted to do in my private life. And the private life was wrapped around this whole issue of the spiritual quest. But I found that when I was in the ministry, my time was taken up with so many other things that had nothing to do with the spiritual journey, that I really had a tremendous longing to want to pursue that. And it took me 15 years to finally get up the courage to leave the church and then to begin to engage in this kind of work in a more consistent, more full-time manner.
Okay. I have to admit something to you.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up as a Southern Baptist, and then I converted to a conservative Jew, and now I'm nothing. So I really have issues when I start reading about people who think they are enlightened and Jesus did it.
Oh, yeah, right.
So I have that problem, and so that's what I thought you were going to tell me at first.
No. I went through the whole religious conservative thing myself, you know, and I went through that, you know, the conversion experience. But there was somehow that never touched the tremendous experience of moving into that other dimension, that change in consciousness, that shift in awareness that happened when I fell off the roof, and that happened to me at a number of other occasions in my life as well. And I began to view things much more through the mystical perspective than anything else, and the change in consciousness that can happen through that. And between you and me, since we're both we're refugees from the conservative movements, I really think that Jesus was a mystic at his heart. So I think I think the church has missed the point in that in a big, big way. And that's part of what I'm hope to do is to make those connections for people back to that mystical experience.
I think he was a rabbi too.
Yes,
you know,
I agree.
And rabbis
absolutely
have to be married, and they're supposed to have kids and procreate, so I just have a problem with all of that. So
right.
I have two questions for you. One of them I want you to answer in a minute, which is
okay. You
said you had a shift in consciousness. What is that? What is consciousness?
Oh, you know, I have yet to come across anybody who has a definition for that word consciousness. When I use the word consciousness, and when I talk about the shifts in consciousness, we have, and this is my own perspective on it. I think that we've been taught a certain form of consciousness in our society, and that's the normal adult waking consciousness that is preoccupied essentially with survival in the physical world.
So are you saying that word is synonymous with awareness?
In a lot of ways, it is, or a perspective.
Is that how you use it?
For me, it is, yeah.
Okay.
Right. So you can be aware of this physical reality, and that tends to be the predominant mode of awareness in our culture. But there are also many other ways, other perspectives that you can be aware of as well. And some of them happen within the physical world, and many of them happen outside of the physical world as well.
Mm-hmm. So... well, I hate to get you to it. You're not a scientist, are you?
No, I don't pretend to be. But, you know, give it a shot anyway. It's okay.
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, what's his name? Tom Campbell.
Yeah,
his perspective,
right.
You know, is consciousness is the ground of all being, or, you know, equating it to the irreducible unit. And that's
right.
One of the problems because in the world, because so many people use that word, but they all have a different meaning for it, so nobody can have a meeting of the minds about what they're talking about when they use that word. That's why I ask you that.
One of the problems that you inevitably run into whenever you're talking about issues of metaphysics or issues of consciousness, you're talking about experiences in our language to contain them.
Uh-huh.
Our language is tied to physical experience, physical reality, and so when
mm-hmm.
we're talking about things that go beyond that, we're always going to be in that gray area where we don't have words to define the experience. And that's always been the problem of anybody who has moved beyond the confines of the traditional is to come back and describe it in a way that makes sense to other people who haven't been there.
Yeah, linguistics is definitely a problem when it comes to that.
Clearly.
So let me ask you this. How did that experience affect how you taught your congregation?
Well,
did you teach them traditional, conventional religion, or did you change it to what you knew what was real?
A combination of both, actually. One of the things I began to find over the years is that if you're going to speak to somebody, somehow you have to use a language that at least they are somewhat familiar with, even though it's going to be inadequate. So a lot of times I would sneak metaphysical things into my sermons, and those who were aware of that would get it, and those who weren't, it would just kind of go over their heads. And it was so funny because I'd be greeting people after the service, and my wife would be standing next to me, and they'd say, "Oh, Paul, that was just the greatest sermon. That was wonderful." And Jackie, my wife, would whisper in my ear, "If they had any idea what you really meant, that you would lose your job tomorrow." And she was right, you know. So it was a fine line to walk for 15 years. And
give me an idea. I mean, show me, like, something, because I think that's interesting. Give me an idea how you would do that.
It was a pretty subtle thing, but you know, I was always trying to help people to make the connection with, say, for instance, things that would happen in the Bible that people think were just available to those who were spiritually wonderful as opposed to the rest of us. And so I would be trying to make connections with, like, say, Moses at the burning bush. You know, that's a mystical vision that he was having there. That same kind of thing is available to us as ordinary people. Or if you dream interpretation, that's available to us as ordinary people. Or Paul on the road to Damascus having this experience of encountering a dead person, that is available to us in the here and now as ordinary people. So those are some of the points that I was trying to make for people.
Did you struggle teaching them something? Well, first of all, do you think that the Bible is the text now that you've had that experience?
I think it's one text, and I think where so many people get off base is to think of it as this thing that's written in stone. And it is never going to change, never realizing that it's a text that has been evolving over time. And for me, it really is a conversation between generations of people who have encountered the extraordinary and are struggling to try and understand that. And so they're doing the best they can, and they write about that, and then future generations look at that, and they add to the writings and so on and so forth. I really think that when you see it more as a conversation than as something that is written in stone, it comes to life so much more.
It makes, yeah, I agree with that. So what happened to make you transition to Monroe? Was that a hard thing for you to do, to leave doing that?
It was. Yeah, it's
Christianity.
Especially, you know, when I'm making my living as a minister, and I had three children and a wife to support, and it was very difficult to make that decision to move into something where I was going to have to risk all of that. But we're getting ahead of the story. For me, it really started back a couple years after I was into the ministry. My wife and I were up in Toronto, Canada, and we visited what was called the world's biggest bookstore. They had books just as far as the eye could see, and I was in there for just a couple of minutes, and one book practically jumped off the shelf at me, and it was Robert Monroe's second book, which was called Far Journeys. Now, Robert Monroe had written a series of three books about his experiences of out-of-body experiences, and when I read that book, it was so compelling to me, because for the first time, here was somebody who was really connecting with my experience when I fell off of the roof. And the reason why it was so compelling was he wasn't talking theology or philosophy or speculation. He was simply relaying his own personal experience. And believe me, you me, when I picked that book up, I read it cover to cover, could not put the thing down, came to the back end of the book and found out that there was a place called the Monroe Institute. And I thought immediately, wow, wouldn't it be amazing to go to a place like that, because you could actually experience what he was talking about. And then the second thought right after that was, wouldn't it be amazing to work at a place like that, never realizing that would be my destiny.
That's amazing.
Mm.
So how did it happen?
Well, actually, I got so interested in this stuff that finally someone paid my way to go. You know, when you're a pastor, you don't have a lot of discretionary income or discretionary time, but a friend of mine paid my way to go, and I went to my first Gateway Voyage there at the Institute, and that world that I had longed for so long suddenly opened up in living Technicolor, and the experiences that I had there were so far beyond anything that I could have hoped for. It was like finding literally manna from heaven as far as I was concerned, because this was something my soul was and my spirit was hungering for so long.
Tell me how that, what you did. I want to know about that. I want my listeners to know about that. What did you do when you got there? How long did it take, and what was the experience?
Sure. A normal course begins on a Saturday evening, and it goes through the following Friday morning. So that's a 5.5-day, 6-day course. And the way it works is that everybody has what they call a check unit. That's an acronym for controlled, holistic environmental chamber. And all that really amounts to is a bed that has four walls, or I kind of call it a bed in a box.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason why the bed is surrounded by the four walls and the ceiling is just to keep the outside distractions to a minimum so that you can begin to focus on what's going on in your internal world. And then the Monroe Institute has developed over the years an audio technology that helps people to move in deep meditative states and gets them into those states really very quickly compared to other methodologies. So, for instance, you would go in and lie in your bed. And by the way, this is the same bed that you would sleep in at night.
Mm-hmm.
You go in there and put some headphones on, and they play an experience or an exercise for you. And you allow yourself to be guided via the audio technology. And gradually you learn the skill of moving beyond the confines of your normal waking awareness to begin to explore many other avenues of perception that are available to you. And so the way I like to explain that is that if you pay attention to when you are falling asleep at night, you will notice that your body gets progressively more and more relaxed until you cross over this threshold. And once you cross over that threshold, you lose consciousness of the waking reality, and you move into a consciousness of other landscapes, your dream landscape or your visionary landscape. And then when you come back in the morning, you cross over that threshold again, you remember fragments of that as dreams or visions or whatever. What we help people to do is to get progressively more and more relaxed, move up to that threshold, and then begin to cross over that threshold with their normal waking consciousness, so that those realms that are normally reserved for unconsciousness can be explored by the conscious mind.
Now, is that using binaural beats?
Yes. But it's a very complex binaural beat.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps your listeners may not know what binaural beats are, so I'll just explain that very quickly.
Sure.
To them. If you have two musical tones that are very close together, say one that is a frequency of 100 beats per second, and a second one that is just a little bit different from that, maybe 104 beats per second. If you're playing those two tones simultaneously, one in each ear, you will hear kind of a wavering or a vibrato that is the difference between them, or about 4 cycles per second. And once that happens, that's a third tone that gets created in the brain, and that creates an environment for the brain then to want to start to resonate with that third frequency. And that seems to be the pathway and the doorway that allows the brain to move into these alternate ranges of experience and perception.
And it's that, do I use 4 hertz or 3.8? Because I know that's important.
Well, actually, it's much more complicated than that. What I just described to you is very quick and dirty explanation. The signals are very complex, and the reason for the complexity is because if that complexity wasn't there, the brain would habituate to that straight binaural beat and start to ignore it. So the complexity adds to the richness of the auditory environment and keeps the brain interested enough in this new context to want to move there.
What do you mean complexity? What happens? Do you change, like, the tone or the note?
The complexity of the the complexity of the waveform. In other words, there may be a series of waveforms that are superimposed on each other that interact in various ways. And it's also embedded in pink noise, too, to help to reduce some of the irritating effects of binaural beats. So that combined with the verbal guidance on the exercises, those two things seem to work very well to help people to move into these altered states.
How long did it take you to have your first experience?
You mean when I was at the Institute?
Huh? When you first went the first time.
Okay. I think it was probably the first day that I began to experience some pretty interesting things. It's kind of like an acquired taste in some way, so there is a bit of a learning curve to it, but the learning curve is primarily simply letting go of your expectations and allowing the process to work. That's sometimes more difficult than it sounds, but those people who are able to let go of the expectations the quickest tend to progress the fastest.
Okay. So did you hear from your congregation after you left?
Actually, when I went, before I'd gone, I had started a small group of people who were doing meditation, and we were also experimenting with various healing practices. And when I came back, I was just so bowled over, and I just had to share it with this group. And they were a very trusted group, and they were very, very excited about what I had found out. And it wasn't long after that that I created a seminar for this small group and just a few other people, where I began to use some of the experiences of, or the technology of, the Monroe Institute. And I worked very hard to try and put it into the, frame it in the language of our tradition, so that they wouldn't feel as if they were out in left field. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that people gravitated to it like gangbusters. As one person said, you know, I've been searching for this all my life, and I just didn't know what it was. And so that was the thing that led me to understand that this whole thing is a very, very important aspect that a lot of people are looking for, both within the religious traditions and many outside the religious traditions.
So I'm curious, when you tried to describe them when you came back, when you wanted to talk to them without stepping on their toes, how did you think that? And there's a reason I'm asking you this. One day I'll tell you what it is.
Sure. Okay. For me, one of the things I've found through the years is that if you just tell a story, It tends to disarm people, but if you're moving in the realm of beliefs and you're approaching it from that perspective, you're just going to run head on into resistance. Mm-hmm. So all I did was I began to tell them some of the experiences that I had there, and they were fascinated with that. And that disarming aspect of storytelling, I think, is a very, very powerful way of sort of moving subversively beyond beliefs.
So how did you end up going to the Monroe Institute to work? How'd that happen?
Well, in the year 2000, I was feeling this tremendous tension, as I mentioned before, between what my heart was really calling me to do. After I'd done those few programs for people in my church using the technology and realized how powerful and important it was, I felt a real strong desire to want to write about this and to move more fully into it. So in the year 2000, I informed the session of our church that I was leaving the ministry. And 2 months after I walked out the door of the church, I received a call from the Monroe Institute asking me if I wanted to become a residential facilitator up there, which was a very powerful thing for me, because it reminded me of when I had read Bob Monroe's book so many years before, when I had those two things that came into my mind, which was, wouldn't it be amazing to go there? And the second thought, which was crazy, wouldn't it be amazing to work there? It was almost as if my future self had come back and whispered in my ear all those years before. And so it was very profound when I got that phone call from the Institute.
So when you left your work, you didn't know that you were going to have a job, and
2 months
later you had the dream job.
That's correct. Although I did hedge my bets, I have to confess. When I left the ministry, I went back into the construction business and created my own little business that could also give me time to write. And so between that and the work that I did at the Institute, I was able to also write the book.
Do you remember how we connected?
You and I?
Yeah.
No, I don't. Can you remind me?
Uh-huh. I will. About maybe 2 years ago, Jim Beal called me one day, and he goes, write this phone number down. You have got to get this guy on your show. And it was Tom Campbell. And a bunch of stuff happened at my house, and I moved, changed my house around. I moved from upstairs to downstairs. Anyway, I lost the number, and I just never made it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So then about the first time I contacted you, about a week before I contacted you, I got this email, and it was from Bob Monroe. It was on my Facebook or somewhere, and it had his picture on it, and it said, hi, Eva, this is Bob Monroe, and I just wanted to tell you that I've been listening to your radio program, and I really like it, and thank you for what you're doing. Keep it up, or something like that.
Isn't that something?
And I was like, I thought Bob Monroe was dead, so I don't know what to say, you know? So I wrote back and I said, I've heard a lot about you from Jim Bill. Thank you for taking the time to write me or something like some brief thing. Because I know what to say because I knew he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I get back an email either from you or the some other woman there. I can't remember who called first.
Okay.
And that's how we connected. Isn't that bizarre?
Isn't that something? Well, you know, Bob Monroe was kind of a wily guy. You never could figure out what he was going to be doing next, so it doesn't surprise me that he'd be writing you emails from the other side. So
it certainly surprised me. All right. So tell me what you would like to tell the world about what's happened to you and how you would direct them to go.
Well, for me, I think that one of the things that we have got to rediscover is this whole spiritual aspect of our lives. For some reason, our culture has put us in a kind of a bind here where the sum total of our experience and our concern is relegated to the very narrow section of physical reality, and in interacting with the physical world and bending the physical world to our own comforts and desires. And I think that we have narrowed the human capacity dramatically as a result of that. We have to begin to understand that we are much more than our physical bodies. We are much more than the physical world. And until we begin to understand that at some profound level and an experiential level, we're going to continue to down this very dangerous path of raping the world of its resources and warring with others over the limitations that are available to us. And for me, the future of the world lies in the ability of human beings to discover this expanded capacity of what is truly possible for us. And if people are really paying attention, they will understand what I'm talking about, because they will know intuitively that they have this longing for something more. And that more is not going to be found in manipulating the material world. That more is only going to be found as we expand the capacity of our perception and our explorations. And the spiritual domain is there for us to explore, and it's the thing that will ultimately lead us and complete us as human beings.
So what is your perspective on free will? Do you think we have free, complete free will?
That's a
think about that carefully, how I worded that. Complete
yeah.
free will.
Yeah, you know, I tend to stay away from speculations like that. I tend to just move with experience rather than trying to deal too much with philosophy. Because the questions that I've never been able to answer, for some reason, I've never been able to answer. And but that, for me, is doesn't change the fact that there is this range of experience that's available to us. Whether it's available by free will or not, is not that big of an issue for me.
It's a topic that I'm interested in, though,
mm-hmm.
and you're at the place that does the research on it.
Mm-hmm.
If we, and you're a minister, you're a previous minister, so it's something I have to focus on.
You're going to drag me into this
uh-huh.
one way or another, aren't you? Okay.
I've never had the opportunity to interview a previous Christian minister.
Okay.
All right. So if you approach an average person on the street and say, do you think we have the free will, they're going to say, absolutely, we have free will. I can do anything I want to do.
Mm.
But do we really have free will? If we really had free, complete free will, would we ever have a bad thing? Would you have fallen off the roof? Would you have broken your hip?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. For me, it's a very difficult issue when I look at my own personal experience, right?
Or is it a reality that's previously created and we just go along in the movie?
Mm. Well, it certainly does seem like that when I view my own life, because there seem to be so many incidences that have taken me on a path that was unexpected and unanticipated that I certainly did not choose. So does that mean there's free will in that? I really don't know. But I do know one thing that would seem to mitigate the whole question. It seems to me that you can only have free will if you have awareness. But if you're not aware, if you are just moving along with the stream of humanity, or if you are continually hemmed in by the dictates of society, you don't have free will there anyway. You might think you do, but you're really more like a robot. And for me, if there is free will, it has to come with some form of awareness where you can move beyond the limitations of your society.
Okay, let's talk about that for a minute, awareness. Mm-hmm. Do you think that awareness exists in gradients?
I do. I do. I think there are times, people have talked about enlightenment and having that sense of knowing all, and that's probably not a gradient when they're talking about that, but I think there are movements toward that ideal, and we can be anywhere along that spectrum at any given time.
Have you read Hawkins' work on that, David Hawkins' work on consciousness and gradients?
No, I haven't. Tell me about that.
Oh, no, that's a whole other conversation.
Okay.
I take up the time of you.
Okay.
You know, and I want you to tell your story. I mean, that you might find it interesting doing what
okay.
you do.
Uh-huh.
It's called Power versus Force.
I did read that. I did read that. That was a number of years ago. I had forgotten
mm-hmm.
his name. Right. Yeah.
So, if now that you know that you've read that, where would you find Christianity on those gradients, or fundamental religions?
Mm.
Does that make sense? Does that question?
Yeah,
make sense?
Yeah. It's difficult to to pin something like that down. It seems to me fundamental religions, and I forget its categories because it's been so long ago that I read it. But
like fear-based, maybe?
Yeah, they're much more fear-based. In fact, I think fear is the basis for the more fundamentalist religions, because what they're doing is creating a world that is very close and very closed, and anything outside of those boundaries is to be rejected and feared. As you move further, I think, in the movement of consciousness and awareness, I think you lose a lot more of that fear-based perspective, and you move much more with a love-based perspective and a much more trusting perspective of the world, because you know that there is something guiding you along the way.
After you had your experience, did you become more, or any of your experiences, your broken hip or the thing at Monroe Institute,
mm-hmm.
did you become more intuitive?
Yes. In fact, I think I've noticed that more and more in the last few years here, especially since I took this job as executive director, I'm finding that very often as I move through the day, I will get inklings and intuitions that I need to go and talk to this person, or I need to walk here and I will bump into exactly the person I need, or I need to talk to somebody and the phone will ring. And that's been very, very pronounced within the last few years for me.
Mm-hmm. What about synchronicities?
Yeah, I'm beginning to think that most of life is synchronicity.
You start having a lot more?
Well, I'm not sure whether it's a question of having more or being aware
of
them. Or
noticing them. Yeah, exactly. That's a better way
yeah.
to put it.
Yeah, I think I'm more aware of them now than I've ever been before.
Did you have, obviously this is a lot more than about your book, so I hope that's
mm-hmm.
okay.
That's okay. It's a pleasure to talk with
you. Did you have any kind of epiphany about what you think's happening to the world in the next few years? Because, a lot of people that wake up like that do.
Of course, everybody's all excited about 2012. I don't know what's going to happen in 2012. I do have a sense, however, that humanity as a whole is moving to a new stage of awareness, or a new stage of consciousness, a new way of understanding our place within the world. And for me, that is that fundamental integration of the spiritual domain into the physical life, so that we begin to bridge between those two worlds in a way that is much more constructive than what we are doing now. As far as a timetable on that, is it going to happen by 2012? I have no idea. But I do know that as I'm looking at the people who come through the Monroe Institute, and I'm seeing a greater sense of maturity and a greater awareness from so many of them, that there does seem to be a shift that's happening really pretty quickly here, and much faster than I would have thought at one time. When I think back to the groups that I was a part of when I first came to the Institute, and then I compare them to the groups that are coming through now, say maybe 12 or 13 years later, there's quite a dramatic difference.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So when you, back to your church again, because I just found that fascinating, mm-hmm. How do you explain to them about, or did you talk to them about heaven and hell? And
yeah.
What you probably now perceive it to be, or perceive afterlife to be, it's different
right.
Understanding.
Right. Well, from my perspective, when Jesus was talking about the kingdom of heaven, he wasn't talking about something that was an after-death reality, but something that was a present reality that is available to us right here and right now. And, you know, some examples of that were, you know, when he went to the Mount of Transfiguration and his disciples were with him, they moved into an altered state of reality at that point in time. Or Jesus would say, the kingdom of heaven is within you, or it's among you. It's not going to be, but it is within you right now. So for me, this points to something that is a present reality. And as long as we're looking for heaven and hell as something that's an after-death reality, we're going to miss the true potential that we have right here and now.
Did they get that?
Some did, actually, and particularly the small group that I had where we were doing meditation and where I was doing some of these Monroe experiences for them. And actually, I just recently did a program for a Presbyterian church down in Orlando, and we had about 20 people there for that, and helped them to begin to make those connections. And they were ecstatic about what had happened. And I think the key here is not so much, you know, the words that we use or the theology behind it, but giving people the actual experience of moving into these ranges of perception is the real key to everything. When that happens, then it's like the blinders come off and people go, now I understand. That makes all the difference in the world.
So when you go and give a lecture like that, do you take headphones and your stuff, or is it just a lecture
right.
where you tell the story?
I do both, actually. It depends on the amount of time that I have available. For the program that I did down in Orlando, that was a two-day program, so we had plenty of time to explore the different, several different destination points in consciousness, and maybe I should say a word about what I mean by that. At the Monroe Institute, we've created a map of consciousness. It is a map. It's not the map by any means, but it's one that tends to be pretty helpful to people. And these different destination points of consciousness are designated by numbers, and so we will call the first destination point Focus 10. And Focus 10 is the experience of mind awake, body asleep. In other words, your body is very deeply relaxed, almost to the asleep point. Sometimes it is asleep, but you're still maintaining that waking consciousness. So that's the first place that we go to. Second place we go to is what we call Focus 12, which is the state of expanded awareness. And then Focus 15, which is the state beyond time and space. And then in our first program, the last place that we go to is Focus 21, which is the bridge state between physical reality and non-physical experience.
And that's a two-day program?
Actually, that would be our five-and-a-half-day program. In our two-day program, we just go to Focus 10 and Focus 12. Gives
okay.
people pretty good taste.
Now, is this mobile? Can you take it somewhere?
Yes. In fact, the two-day program is designed to be exactly that. We have it's what we call our outreach program. And we have a number of outreach facilitators who can give this two-day program in any location that's off campus. So we've been training outreach facilitators all over the world, so we can cover quite a few places at this point. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you want to go to a residential program, right now we are giving them in our campus at Virginia. We have some West Coast locations where we do them. We're also doing them in Japan, Brazil, Europe. We will be doing them in Australia before long, Puerto Rico. So we're expanding quite a bit at this point.
So if you went, let's say you came to Atlanta to a facility here.
Mm-hmm.
Would they need beds, or could they just sit on the floor on their mats, or how do you work it?
We could do it several ways, but the best way is we now have a radio system where we can actually broadcast to little MP3 players, and people can go back into their individual rooms and listen to the experiences there. We find that's the best. But hotels are not generally the best location for that because there are too many distractions, so a retreat center of some kind would be much preferable.
Okay. All right. So you got about 10 minutes. You get to talk about what you want to talk about now.
Well,
and be sure and tell us where we can find you, okay? That's important.
Oh, sure. Okay, let's start off with that. People can find information about the Monroe Institute at monroeinstitute.org. That's M-O-N-R-O-E, institute.org. They can also find information about my book at spiritualhitchhiker.com. And I guess the thing that I wanted to mention to people is that how important I see this whole range of experience as being. It's so important to move beyond talking about something to including it as part of your lived experience. When we experience something, it's a completely different order of knowing. It transcends words and it transcends verbiage so that it becomes a very compelling aspect of our being. So, for me and for so many others, that's what we do at the Monroe Institute that is so very, very powerful, that we provide a context in which people can begin to explore for themselves and out of their own experience and begin to expand very dramatically what they thought they were in the past. You know, the perennial wisdom has always been know thyself. And for so long in our society, we've shrunk down that knowable part of ourselves into that very narrow range of physical experience. But once you start to move into other ranges of perception, then that dramatically changes how you see yourself in the world, and also your own self-understanding, and also your concept of what is possible in this world. And I think that the more people who can begin to move into those ranges of actual personal experience of the perception of non-physical entities and worlds, the bigger impact it's going to make on this planet.
I totally agree.
Hmm.
I really do. So what would a two-day excursion cost to go to the Monroe Institute, and what does a week excursion costs, and where would you stay? Do people stay on campus, or
right.
How does that work?
Well, for the two-day excursion, that's going to be something that's not usually done on our campus. That'll be done in a retreat center and in a variety of locations, or sometimes they do use smaller hotels, that kind of thing. And the cost on that's going to vary according to what cost the outreach facilitator is facing in terms of the accommodations. As far as our residential facility is concerned and the six-day program there, the cost on that is $1,995, and that includes room and board. And we provide the place where you stay, so you will be sleeping in the same bed that you'll be listening to the audio exercises. And we provide all meals, and essentially you can come and not have to worry about a thing. And I think that's one of the really great things about this experience is that you get a chance to move out of your daily life and to focus exclusively on exploring this vast resource that we have available to us, which is the inner world. And when you do that, then because you're not always faced with the distractions of daily life, you can find that one experience can start to build on the other and can build on the next one so that the baseline of your awareness really goes through a pretty dramatic change as you move through the week. And so go ahead.
Can you bring about enlightenment, or do you just simply get to experience different things?
Well, some people do have what they would call experiences of enlightenment, but I would say for the average person, you get to explore what it means to move beyond the confines of your physical world and your physical body. And that can take a variety of forms. Some people will have out-of-body experiences. Some people will encounter deceased loved ones. Some people will have a great expansion of their own personal perception. Some people will have healings. But most of all, I think the important thing is that people just get a sense of this greatly expanded possibility and capacity of what it means to be human. And when you're working on that within a group setting, you get the richness of not just your own personal experience, but you also get to hear the stories of everyone else in the group as they're moving through the processes as well. And that, of course, is guided to a large extent, or to some extent, by our facilitators. But the thing that I think has real integrity with what we do is that at the Monroe Institute, we don't have any gurus and we don't have any teachers. We just have facilitators who are creating a context for your own personal exploration. What we want is for people to begin to trust their own intuition and their own insight and their own guidance as they're moving through these processes. And if we feel if they can do that, then we've really accomplished a great deal.
And do they still do research there?
Yes. Yes, we do.
Who's doing that?
We just hired a new research director, and her name is Hillary Webb. She started July 1st, as a matter of fact. The research was started years ago by Robert Monroe, who the reason why he engaged in research was because he was having spontaneous out-of-body experiences, and he couldn't control them.
And
he wanted some way to find some kind of control over them, and then so he was trying everything under the sun and eventually came across the sound technology that we're using now. And then for about 20 years, Skip Atwater became our director of research. And so he was using most of his time to try and understand more completely how this technology worked. But then he got a little frustrated with that and started to move from quantitative research to more qualitative research because he realized that no matter how many times he did brain mapping on someone, he could never get to their experience. Okay. So he started relying more on qualitative reporting to see if there were commonalities in the experiences that people were having. And then Hillary Webb coming on board now is going to be starting an entirely new era of research for us in which we're going to hopefully collaborate with a lot more outside organizations, and we hope that we can also become a hub for information in the whole field of consciousness.
What is her background?
She just received her PhD from Saybrook University.
Okay.
She is she's working in the field of anthropology and consciousness. She's also the managing editor for the Journal of Anthropology and Consciousness magazine.
And what is it, what is her first project?
You know what? She's so new on the thing. We're just trying to figure out what that's going to be. One of the things that we're very excited about is the University of Virginia, which is just right up the street from us, has a division of perceptual studies, and this is an outgrowth of Ian Stevenson's work. Mm-hmm. And they're doing very creative stuff in researching paranormal type of experiences, near-death experiences, reincarnation stories, a broad range of things. And so we're looking very much forward to that collaboration with them.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
So lots of happening right now, I can tell you that.
Is there a lab there?
Yes, we have a laboratory. In fact, we have two of them. And what I mean by a laboratory is that we have super-duper check unit. In other words, it's a super insulated and isolated chamber with a water bed that has a salt solution in there and then a monitor station outside of that booth so that anyone who's going through these experiences can communicate directly with the monitor. And the monitor then can shift the audio environment to help to move these people to move through the various focus levels and to report their experiences.
Okay. All right. Well, tell us one more time where we can reach you.
Okay. The Monroe Institute is, you can find us on web at monroeinstitute.org. I do want to emphasize the .org portion of that because we are a nonprofit organization. And you can also call us for more information, and the number is 434 561-1500.
Thank you, Paul.
It's been a pleasure, Eva.
I appreciate you.
Yeah, have a great day.
You too. Good night.